They have black and white thinking, meaning somebody or something is all good or all bad. And they will praise people or praise things until they perceive they've been done wrong, and then you're on the blacklist.
Candid conversations that might just change how you look at the world. Let's bridge cultures, transcend borders, and build a global family of changemakers. Welcome to If By Chance.
How we see ourselves can profoundly impact the quality of our relationships. But sometimes our perceptions might not be what others see. Seeking feedback from trusted friends or professionals like Andrea Atherton can help provide valuable insights to improve our interactions and strengthen our connections.
I've been a psychotherapist for 28 years. I'm an experiential therapist, so I do yoga, trauma-informed therapy. I do art therapy and couples. And I integrate mindfulness and consciousness into my couples counseling. And then I've kind of have an offshoot of a non-therapeutic blueprint for helping couples increase their intimacy and helping singles kind of fall in love with themselves so they can find the love that they're looking for.
And for those that don't know what psychotherapy is, can you explain that?
I can. And mine's a little bit different. So it's called different things. It can be counselor. So I'm a counselor. I'm trained. I have a master's degree in art therapy and counseling. And basically, it's using the more therapeutic modalities to help people. It's more based in a medical model to help people. And it's usually a longer process than my consulting is. So depending on people's issues, and a lot of times I see people with trauma, people with mood disorders, and then couples in various stages of wherever they're at. Oftentimes, unfortunately, couples come in when it's the last resort. It's their last ditch effort to save the marriage. And oftentimes it's hard to come from a below the, and oftentimes one person already wants out. So not that it can't be resolved if I can get both of the people deciding to put both feet in and committing to it. They can move on. That's why I created the blueprint. So people don't feel like they have to go to therapy. They can maybe start with the blueprint. And then if they're needing more, they can, go into the therapeutic model.
And what kind of mood disorders are you dealing with?
So a lot of bipolar disorder and depression is mainly the mood disorders. Anxiety can be tied into that as well. But when I'm, talking about depressed moods, there's also many other depression, major depression light, like dysthymia and things like that. So, and people can go through situational depression too, like if they're grieving, and I'm a trained grief counselor too, or, if they have a loss of a relationship.
Bipolar, how is before they see you, or where are they usually at?
Oftentimes I can diagnose too. So I am very, careful. I use the DSM-5, and oftentimes I won't diagnose right out the gate, but as I get to know somebody, sometimes I'll diagnose, and sometimes they'll be already seeing a psychiatrist for medication. Because bipolar oftentimes needs medication treatment as well as the psychotherapy.
So what might somebody see that could possibly suggest that they might have bipolar?
That's a good question. And I think there's a lot of misnomers about what bipolar is. Just like these days we throw around they're a narcissist, or they're love bombing me, they're gaslighting me. They throw around these psychological terms, and I can't diagnose somebody, or if somebody disappoints you, it doesn't mean they're a narcissist. We used to use the term for mood swings as, oh, I'm bipolar or they're bipolar. And actually, bipolar isn't up and down like every day, like our weather, Stacey. our weather isn't bipolar. Bipolar actually is goes up and down no more than four times a year. Oftentimes, that's usually the place. Some people can have unipolar, where only comes up to midline. It doesn't come up to that euphoric, manic. So it can look like that. That's harder to diagnose, and often people with unipolar, but they still have that swing, but they get depressed, or they get diagnosed with depression. Oftentimes, it looks a little bit different for everybody. It looks different for how the mood swings are, but how you really can tell it's bipolar is, I think, the mania. And if people don't respond to antidepressants, that's a big tell that it's bipolar disorder.
So about this, the euphoria and mania, how would you know if you're seeing that?
Yeah. Sometimes it's easier to see. People don't sleep. They usually don't eat. They're very creative. So I remember I had one client who would rollerblade like nonstop when he was manic till his feet bled. And it's oftentimes a really good feeling, that's when I'm like euphoria. You feel so good about yourself. And especially after being depressed and you come back up, you feel like you were gained a new life. But oftentimes it's with impulsive behavior. Oftentimes you see it with drug use, people getting angry really quickly. It's just like a heightened, almost like pressurized euphoria.
Is it something that the rollerblading and things, my mind is going to, certain children that you might see who are always on the go and you can never get them to eat and that kind of thing. So is it something that you might have your whole life or not?
It is, but it's harder to diagnose. A lot of diagnoses aren't diagnosed in childhood. And usually when I see I've seen young people with bipolar, but I'm always careful about that because there's so many developmental changes, especially during the teens. Mostly people are diagnosed in their mid or later teens when their personality settles in a little bit and all the other things are ruled out. Like trauma or ADHD, you have to be very careful when diagnosing a mm-hmm. child.
And present with ADHD and bipolar?
They can. I mean, like anything's possible, but there's like trauma, autism, ADHD, a lot of the symptoms are crossover. So it's very delicate. That's why it's like I like to work with people a little bit before giving them a diagnosis. And I don't like to label people like you are bipolar. You are suffering from bipolar, and helping them kind of cope with that rather than over-identify with the diagnosis.
So I knew someone who had borderline personality disorder. Can you talk to
me? And what did you notice?
I noticed that at times this individual could be quite judgmental and snappy when I wasn't necessarily expecting it. Not towards me, but in terms of their opinion about others that might be in our surroundings. So, yeah, that's what I noticed.
Yes. And do you know what? Borderline personality disorder can also be misdiagnosed as manic depressive or bipolar disorder too. There's a lot of crossover. The impulsiveness, the anger, the agitation sometimes.
Yeah, finds this individual seemed so relaxed and so chill with the world. So it was a little bit startling that, something might happen and everybody else is reacting to it as a level two and she'll come off as a level 7 out of 10.
Mm-hmm. And yes, and if you think of somebody with borderline personality disorder, and all oftentimes it's called access to personality disorders. And oftentimes a lot of narcissism gets just blanketed over. People with borderline personality disorder can show some narcissistic traits, but they have a sense, usually comes from trauma and, you know, the need to control, but they feel very empty inside. And their focus is always on trying to control the external so they can calm down. But you know how we can control things outside of ourselves? Not at all. So oftentimes they get flustered and, you know, they blame people for how they feel. But another attribute to it is they also punish people. They have a lack of empathy. And if they believe somebody did something to them, they hold on to it. And oftentimes there's retribution for what you've done, or you maybe have seen it with other people or heard what they've done to other people.
Mm-hmm. There was definitely some grudge holding. What does the borderline mean?
I'm not actually sure exactly where borderline personality disorder comes from the name. That's a good question. I wish I had that answer. But what distinguishes borderline personality disorder is that there are narcissistic traits. Often it comes from trauma, which a lot of other personalities do. It's a splitting of yourself. So they have black and white thinking, meaning somebody or something is all good or all bad. And they will praise people or praise things until they perceive they've been done wrong, and then you're on the blacklist. So there's no gray. They can't really process gray, or they can't have empathy for or perspective of why somebody might act like they did. It's always centered around them.
Is that the same as having multiple personalities?
Okay. So there's controversy here.
Okay.
Multiple personality disorder isn't in the new DSM. It is dissociative identity disorder. And some of the psychologists and psychiatrists do believe that dissociative identity can be linked to bipolar disorder, to borderline personality disorder. So they're kind of go back and forth. Some people will just say, I don't believe in multiple personality at all, but I believe it's a splitting off. Just like I said, the person splits off from themselves. And then with the dissociative identity disorder, it splits off into multiple personalities.
And does that usually come about as a result of trauma?
Yes. Mostly it does. I've also seen it when it's mirrored by an adult with a narcissistic or an access to disorder. Oftentimes, children will become, if they're dealing with that or victims to that, they'll either become a narcissist themselves or borderline themselves, or they'll become an empath and they'll be ultra sensitive to the world around them.
Can you talk to me more about empaths? Because I have heard that for some reason they attract or are attracted to narcissists.
Yes. There's a polarity there because empaths have a tendency, and I'm an empath, I have a tendency to see people whole and healed. And then I'm like, when they don't act like that, you know, with my clients, it's different. But when they don't, I can see everybody, you know, their best parts of them. So that kind of blinds us. And when I have empaths that come in, I teach them, I'm like, know that you're going to be overly sensitive. And sometimes we'll feel other people's emotions and think it's our own. And that's another boundary that empaths have to do. So empathy, that deep empathy or highly sensitive person, it's developed because they're hypervigilant about people's moods, and they're usually the child who will try to placate the parent or try to give them everything so they can feel safe.
It's interesting to me how much of our personality seems to be shaped by our environment, from the way you're talking. Definitely when we have these more extreme characteristics of a personality.
Uh-huh.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Well, 0 to 7 is where our brains, you know, are developing, and when our frontal lobe comes into action, about 4 or 5. So those are the very prime years that our brain is developing in the neurotransmitters and our behaviors. Many, like 90-something% of our behaviors are unconscious and often shaped by our childhood or the things that we believe about ourselves in childhood, or maybe believe about love or believe about relationships, especially about your own self-worth.
Can you talk to me about the growth mindset versus fixed mindset? So if we are mostly formed between 0 and 7 and our brains are quite plastic, how much growth is possible?
Exponential. But you have to know, you know, we can't just do it ourselves. We can't just go up into the mountains. Meditation is great to see how our brain works, but I believe it's having people, like healthy people, mirroring back to us what's going on to help us see. There's some sociologists that did a study, and I love this. They had the people sit down with their friends and have a trusted friend and have them tell what they feel is off in their personality or how they behave. You have to have a pretty strong ego there and have to be open-minded and trust the person. But all our relationships are mirrors to this, but we have to be able to see it. If you think about it, like patterns, like people come to me because they're in a pattern of dating the same guy and not realizing it at the beginning, very, very unconscious behavior. But with that, like working with somebody like that, you get them to see the messages that are in their subconscious that's causing them to continue to choose that way, and then teach them to choose differently. And I think that's where the growth mindset comes in. I'm like, your ego has to be in check enough to be humble and to be vulnerable with these things. And some people just don't get it because they're so attached to their worldview, their perspective. And the growth mindset is too being open to other people. And growth mindset is too how to agree to disagree. But, you know, being open-minded about change and trying things. I'm like, I talk about meditation. And more studies go on about the benefits. And it's so simple, yet people don't do it. I wonder it because it's so simple that people are like, it's not going to change anything. And it really does change a great deal. But just sitting and listening or feeling how your body reacts and what your mind does and creating a little distance does a lot, as does coaching, consulting, and psychotherapy.
I want to come back to that. But first, I want to ask you about what I see sometimes in dating, where instead of going for the same type of person every time, it's almost like a pendulum for some people. Why is that? So let's say, I don't know, somebody goes out with someone who's very tough and masculine and isn't very vocal, and then the next person they choose is a great thinker and you can sit and have a fabulous conversation. Can you tell me what's going on there?
We are very programmed to attract or be attracted to what we felt like as a child. So I don't think somebody can be totally different. Maybe the wrapping looks a little bit different, but we are often attracted. An example, this woman gets divorced from an alcoholic, abusive alcoholic, meets this other man. He's been sober for 20 years or, you know, and so very different. But yeah, there's qualities in there. Or, you know, they don't know this person's an alcoholic, and later on down the line, they are. It's a really hard pattern to break, but it's really important. That's why I always say take a break after a relationship, sort out things. It always takes two. What is your part in it? Because you always have a part, even if you just stay. And I'm not trying to victim shame with it, but what was it that kept you there? Why? Actually, we don't choose unless we become very aware. And it has to be about the relationship with yourself. Because a lot of times, if you haven't healed childhood wounds, there's a defunct with the relationship with yourself. And it goes back to self-love. Oftentimes, children don't feel that love because they had an alcoholic parent, abusive or distant, and they didn't have that love. So it's really important you need to go back to the self-care and the self-love to heal those wounds.
Proportionally, if you look at a population, what percentage of people do you think have that kind of childhood trauma?
And know what? It's not just childhood trauma. People, unfortunately, I think in our culture nowadays, we all have some sorts of trauma. There are some people who haven't at all, or people who are more resilient. I know there's a percentage kind of out there in some studies that people have done. I think it's like 2/3 of the population. But I call them big T's and little T's. So we can have a series of little traumas throughout our life that can equal up to big trauma. And then, or people can have like toxic borderline parents and have big traumas, but people can experience trauma later in relationships or in situations, accidents, or, you know, or natural disasters, wars. So it, you know, in our world right now, unfortunately, I think there's a lot going on. They're discovering that there's more cases of narcissism and narcissistic traits. You know, I can't diagnose everybody, but going on in our world right now, unfortunately.
Do you think that there are more, or we're just more aware of it?
I'm feeling more because I've been in the field a long time. So almost 30 years. So I didn't see as much. And I worked for some like difficult places. I feel like with our dependence on our cell phones, on, you know, on online interaction, it's so much easier. It kind of pulls those traits and attracts people into that, because they can be more deceiving. So if they have like a propensity for it at all, that it's such a great platform to, you know, manifest more of that. And I think overall, even though I can't diagnose, like say, oh, it's 75% narcissist, borderline, access to that, there's a lot more of that going on. Thus, all the language about being gaslit, you know, and ghosted and feeling manipulated.
So as a parent, how can you create an environment where you don't foster that?
Well, it's, you know, it's usually extreme trauma, but as a parent, just being self-aware. And even if this is the difference between somebody with borderline personality disorder and somebody who doesn't, like if somebody comes to me and says, do I have borderline personality disorder? No borderline is aware of it or would even ask that. They usually call other people borderlines, but not themselves. So unfortunately, a lot of parents like that aren't self-aware. It's hard to get treatment when you're not in agreement with it. But I think it's just keeping yourself in check. And as when we become parents and our child is growing up, there's actually triggers that come up at different ages if we experience trauma during that time in our lives. So it's noticing when your triggers come up. I know women who are triggered when they're pregnant, you know, because maybe they had some birth trauma. You know, everybody has birth trauma, but, you know, it, you know, being aware of it, and also, you know, maybe going and getting help if you're feeling very triggered by it.
So it sounds like having a village is a really good idea so that we can look out for our friends and, yeah, just create strong enough relationships so that we can keep an eye on each other.
Relationships and really true connection is really worth more than gold. It keeps us fulfilled. It creates happiness. We can't be happy all the time, but keeps us healthy. And unfortunately, in our society, I think COVID is guilty for it too, is that people are getting less and less vulnerable out in the world in order to be with people or create connections. And I'm not just talking about romantic connections, because I also see people like, well, I'm just going to find a wife or a husband and then we'll hunker down and we don't have to deal with anybody else. And people can't do rejection anymore. Or if they perceive like they've gotten hurt, and I had a client today, and she had a friend who had borderline personality disorder, and she said her friend warned her at the beginning, but she ended up blasting her. You know, they did all these things together. And I'm like, yeah, she totally, you know, she got to a point where she was done with you and she blasted you. But this client admitted that she has been really ambivalent about making other friends. And people feel really lonely and they think they need a romantic relationship. And the first steps to that is being alone with yourself and not feeling lonely. It's developing a relationship with yourself first, because if we go out and we're needy, I don't know if you've ever experienced that, where somebody is like that, it's an energy, that needy energy, and it's just repels people. And that's, you know, people come in and it's just like, I want a girlfriend. This one didn't work and this one didn't work. I'm like, yeah, because if you're gripping onto something, it's like sand, it's just going to go through your fingers. Relationships are much more of a flow, and you need to be able to trust and depend on yourself. And I tell clients too, you need to depend on yourself to assess the relationship and know when you need to get out.
So for those sorts of people that are just constantly busy, they just can't sit with themselves, where can they start?
Like I said, it's definitely meditation, but there's other practices too. Oftentimes the people who don't want to sit with themselves, it's somatic. They don't want to feel their feelings. So by staying busy, you stay up in your brain and you disconnect from the feeling in your body. And when you ignore, especially when you're triggered and the triggers get bigger, that's an opportunity to heal that. But we're so disconnected from our bodies and feeling, and that's the main cause of disease. There's so much linked with, you know, repressed emotions and different diseases. So there's like all different therapies. I'm kind of addressing the somatic therapies that I do. I, you know, had people get in touch with their heart energy. I had people get in touch with their feelings and just sit and take time to feel your feelings. And I think that's why people are afraid to meditate. They're like, oh, I don't know what's going to come up. And you're right. People stay so busy, and it's until they get sick or they're not thinking right and they get in an accident. I kind of always say, well, the universe will slow you down if you don't take time. Do you have a meditation practice?
I used to use the Balance app, particularly during COVID, but I never went beyond the free version. So I don't do it anymore, because I think I just didn't want to listen to the sound of the same voice.
Yes, and there's a lot of different, like Insight Timer, there's a lot of different apps out there. And I know clients who just do them on YouTube. A lot of the meditations don't, some of them do have the advertisements if you have the free version. And you can go. There's a Shamatha meditation, which is a Buddhist meditation that I studied. I was a yoga teacher for 20 years. I still practice and use it in my therapies, but there's a yogic meditation too. And you can learn, it's easier to meditate or learn to meditate in a group of other like-minded energies. So yoga's really great to slow down too. And that's a great way too to get in tune with your body and your breath to connect the mind and the body.
Tried yoga and I didn't really connect with it. But the closest I get to an activity that is meditative is swimming. Do you think that has any value?
Very much. Yeah, that repetitive motion. And yes, it can be. And being in water is very soothing and grounding too. Anything can be a meditation. It's just where your mind is. Like, I'm an art therapist too, and I get lost. It's like moving meditation. It's artistic meditation. It's allowing yourself to be in the process, like with the paint, with the color, like with you, with the water, with how your body is moving, and being mindful in that moment, being totally present. And listeners, if you've ever had a time where you're like, where did the time go? It means you were in that mindful meditative state no matter what you're doing.
Yeah. Some of us who game would say they are in that state.
I think it depends. I think it's more that they're getting sucked into the game itself. So that's not the same kind of mindfulness. They can say they feel like that. Often that's a dopamine thing, because it's like they're getting a lot of dopamine, and kind of dopamine allows you to have motivation and attention. So that's where I think the gaming more is.
Whereas when you're creating art, that's different because...
Well, it can be similar, but it's just more of that mindset, because you are more in your body. You're doing the expression. You're the one who's tapping into the energy and putting the paint on the canvas. So that's where the difference, you know, the difference is. It doesn't, some people can't drop into that state and they're concerned with the outcome versus the process. So I think about any time we're not worried about swimming 15 miles or we're worried about what the picture is going to look like, that's when the ego jumps in. When we're truly mindful, we are just there every moment, every lap, every brush stroke. We are just in those moments. And there's some activities that are allow you to be more mindful than others.
And what about using technology and VR to immerse yourself? So what if we've got a VR headset on and it's taking us into a rainforest?
That's totally different. Lovely music. Okay. I have people with the virtual glasses who go and meditate, where it's just mindfulness is just a state of mind. But there's certain activities that lend itself to that. And if you got goggles on and you're going down so you can be mindful and your breath slows down, and your nervous system slows down, I say, yes, it definitely can be used for that. Just often it's not. And, you know, I believe I think we use those apps like on our phones, but it's just giving us a visualization to move through.
Is there anything that you want to talk about that we haven't so far?
Well, I guess maybe kind of going back to connection and connection with yourself and going back to raising children and mindfulness and raising children. And mindfulness is being present with them. I think this is the gift that we all want and that we should all give to the people we love, is being able to create a container to listen to them, because we all just want to be seen and heard. And that is the biggest validation for children, to feel loved and validated for who they are, not what they do for a parent. And that's the same, like, when it comes to yourself, too. It's validating yourself. It's catching those negative voices that we tell ourselves and being mindful and taking mindful time and not feeling like the doing, going back to the doing, we feel that we need to check off things to be of value. Some people feel like they need to do sacrifice themselves and do for others to be loved. And it's an exchange. And love is actually just the state of who we are. But if you think about it, we want to end with connection is, you know, worth more than gold for our health, our, you know, our state of mind, our mental health. And we focus on being busy and making money, which isn't what we really need. I think if everybody just focused on relationship with others and relationship with themselves, that the world would be a better place rather than taking their value from how much they make, what kind of car they drive. And it's been put into our brain that is value. And if all we do is focus on love and bettering our relationships, it will make the world and our lives so much better. And we're not taught how to do that. You know, I didn't take interpersonal relationships until I was in college. But yet, like all the shop and all these other things were important, that our relationship is, you know, like our wealth. And not just having a lot of people, like a lot of likes on social media. It's having meaningful, deep, vulnerable, intimate relationships.
So I'm going to ask you to set a goal or a way to measure this for those achievement-focused people.
Okay.
If we were to implement a practice in our lives,
okay,
starting today, what should that look like so that we're not just ticking it off and that we're getting the most value out of it?
Hey, start small. We've all been affected by COVID. We're all affected by social media. But what if we were more mindful when we went out, like to the grocery store, and we talked to the person behind us or we talked to the cashier? Why is it we only, are interested in talking to people that can get us something? Why don't we just be mindful about connecting with everybody and making friends? And also not thinking so much about what I need, helping somebody else, holding the door for somebody else, or complimenting somebody. Notice, let people be seen. And then really listen to people. Give people that opportunity to be listened to. And those little steps will strengthen your ability to make connection, but also strengthen your connections and closeness with people.
Life is better shared. And as Andrea suggests, it's perfectly okay to start small.
Now, dear listener, it's your turn. Have you got something to add to the conversation? Then get in touch via the links in the show notes. Whether you have questions, a message of support, or resources that you think might help, we'd love to hear from you. And if by chance you know someone with a story that will inspire others, be sure to let us know. Your contributions help turn inspiration into action, drive positive change, and make life just that little bit better. And if this conversation inspired you to expand your worldview, head to HelloHuman.global to join the conversation.